Welcome to the Real Family Guys podcast with Jeff Emery and Trey Gibson, the show where education and experience collide to help you go deeper in your parenting. Broadcasting from Abilene, Texas, here are your hosts, Jeff and Trey.
Well, hello and welcome to this episode of the Real Family Guys podcast. This is the show where experience and education collide.
Kaboom!
To take you deeper in your parenting. The date today is May the 17th, 2013. I am here with my good buddy, Jeff. Jeff, how are you today, sir?
Good morning, Trey. Today is a good day, I believe. We had a good rain last night, and anytime we got some rain coming down to West Texas, I think it's going to be a good day.
There's a small miracle to that. You know, it was really nice, too. I was up really late last night getting packed up for some stuff, and I tell you, it was really fantastic just to sit out there, because it was that perfect rain for when you have a garden.
Oh, yeah.
Because the slow rains are the best. Those are the ones that just slowly soak that dirt and make it nice and moist underneath there, and we're probably going to put seeds in next week, and it was absolutely schmurfect.
You know, I don't know if I told you this or not, but we have a garden.
You have a garden?
Yeah, we do. A pretty big garden, actually. We've got all sorts of stuff in it, and I say we in the royal we in that well, not actually, that's wrong. Not the royal we. That would be ironically referring to myself again, wouldn't it?
Yeah.
No, I say we in the ironic way that I have nothing to do with it. I am not a yard work kind of guy. I don't like doing it. I've got a service that comes and mows my – now, I don't mind mowing and trimming. I mean, I'm actually okay with that. I grew up with a riding lawnmower and a gas-powered trimmer, and I enjoyed getting out there and doing that. I don't like landscaping. I don't like gardening. I don't like weeding. I don't like any of that stuff. And so I'm a bit of a curmudgeon about that. I mean, and so when Amelia said, "Hey, we want to have a garden," I was like, "That's great for y'all." And sure enough, I mean, they've got a big plot over in Annapapa's yard. They tilled it up. They planted all sorts of stuff and they've been maintaining it. And, except for turning on some water and watering it a little bit, I haven't done diddly squat on it, but we have a garden.
You know, we kind of have – I'm kind of very similar to you in a lot of ways with that too. Like I have never been – see, I worked at – I ran a lawn mowing service over a couple summers, and then I worked for – in my undergrad, I worked for what was called the Toro team there at Tarleton State University, which is just their mowing and landscaping team. And I just did so much of it for so long. That's kind of like you. I just I don't like doing it. I have no desire for it. It brings me no solace or therapeutic quality, like a lot of people say it does. I'm like you. It just irritates me. I don't really want to mess with it. You know, I don't care if I've got to do it necessarily, but I'm kind of like you. But the good thing is, I actually married a lady. We are so converse in so many ways that I feel almost kind of like, you know, less masculine sometimes, but she actually likes to do it, which is really wonderful because she'll actually go outside and work on it. And I actually don't mind staying inside and watching the kids. And so it works out because she'll do most of our yard work for us. But the gardening is my – I do love the gardening. There's something about growing something that you can eat that you don't have to go buy at a grocery store that I feel like it's my rebellious spirit. I feel like I'm sticking it to the man.
That does feel good when you're able to and honestly, that's what we're looking forward to over the summer is being able to go outside and pick beans. And we've already had some broccoli that's come in. We've had some fresh broccoli. And oh, my goodness, broccoli. The difference of being able to snap it off of the plant and bring it in and steam it with some butter and some salt. That's good stuff. Delicious.
Did you know those things will actually flower out?
Flower out? Like,
yeah,
actually,
broccoli,
if you let them grow big enough?
If you let broccoli grow, those little tiny things that are the little florets on your broccoli will actually turn into little tiny yellow flowers.
Broccoli flowers.
It's really kind of pretty, but anyway.
It sounds like a substitute curse word. Broccoli flowers.
Broccoli flowers. Well, guys, we're going to get into our topic for today. We found, Jeff, actually, we kind of both stumbled across this article.
Right.
It was kind of memeing across Facebook. It was kind of went viral, and it was spreading all over the place. And, you know, typically I don't particularly care for Huffington Post parent section exceptionally well. I mean, don't get me wrong. I don't have a problem with their stuff, but I've always kind of felt like they're shock jock in a lot of cases. And and it's about snagging your attention, which I don't have a problem with. That's what media typically does. That's how they market. But, you know, I guess I'm disinclined to like them, maybe I should say. And but they released an article over there written by a lady that I thought – her name was Christine Groslow that I thought was fantastic. And Jeff actually hit me up and said, "Hey, what do you think about this article?" And I had already printed that off because it was so good. So we're going to talk a little bit today about Have American Parents Got It Backwards. And this is the title of the – the article over at Huffington Post. But I mean, I tell you, I'm really excited about this one, Jeff, because I think this one's good. Jeff and I, we have a little bit of different approaches to this. So.
Right, right. At first, it looked like maybe we had some difference of opinion on it. But as we started talking about it, I think that the principles that she comes to are sound. It's just kind of the way she approaches them that kind of made my skepticism alarm go off.
Yeah, absolutely. So we're going to talk a little bit. Again, this is written by Christine Groslow. We will have a link to this in the show notes today. But she asked a question. Have American parents got it backwards? You know, I think it's fascinating that if you really take a look at a lot of the classifications of children that we have, the one that fascinates me the most, and we talk about this actually a lot on the Real Family Guys podcast, but is that we've developed this adolescent category of child, which is very uncommon in other cultures. And we'll skip some of the other details. If you do some back episodes, we kind of go into that world a little bit deeper. And but we've kind of created a very unique classification of kid, which is that adolescence. And so I'm always fascinated by the question of how did we get to that? How do we create kids that in most cultures are adults by now? Mm-hmm. I'm not saying that they act completely adultish. I mean, I've met 80-year-old men that still act like children in some cases. But you know, they're responsible and they go and they do things, and some of them even get married and they stay together for years. And so what are we doing something that is creating these kiddos that aren't ready younger?
Right. As a society, do we create a culture that allows our kids to say kids when they should be moving into more responsible roles and developing into adults without having to go through that adolescent stage? And what is it about how we're parenting that that allows that to happen? And when does it happen? I mean, does it start when they're really young, or does it not? Do we not do the right things in order to help them develop when they're preteens? So that now they've got this adolescent phase they have to go through. I don't know, but Christine Groslow does kind of get to some of that as far as just drawing our attention to how we as a culture create our own unique way of doing things here in America that is not reflected from her experiences and her research going around the world with different parenting styles in other countries around the world. And that's kind of what she highlights in these articles here. If I understand her background correctly, she is an author who wrote a book called Parenting Without Borders: Surprising Lessons Parents Around the World Can Teach Us. And so this HuffPost blog is kind of, I guess, a summary of some of her research. I don't know if it's a teaser for her book, but it raises some really good issues. She says that what she did is she went to over 5 years of living off and on in Japan, investigative trips to Europe and Asia, interviews with psychologists, child development experts, educators, sociologists, in places like Japan, Korea, China, Finland, Germany, Sweden, France, Spain, Brazil, and elsewhere. So there's no doubt that she did her research. There's no doubt that she went around and really gathered some good information about how all these different countries do it. What kind of bothered me about the article, Jay, just to kind of set the I guess my position on this, is it feels like after doing all this research and seeing how other parents do it in other countries, she kind of came back and did a side-by-side comparison and said, well, if it works well in these countries, why can't we do it in America? Which is an okay question to ask, but the tone of the question makes it sound like, or at least the way this article is written, makes it sound like they're doing it better over there, and therefore we're somehow deficient. And while that may be the case, I really want to examine that so it's not a side-by-side comparison. Rather, it's a, hey, well, let's look at what's going on over here, and is that something that we would want to do over here? Does that necessarily mean that there's something wrong with the way we're doing it in America? Those are the kind of questions I think could have been fleshed out a little bit more, and maybe they are in her book. But as you mentioned, these articles are kind of designed to get your attention and to kind of shock you into reading them. So maybe it did exactly what it was intended to do.
Well, let's go ahead and jump in.
Sure.
To these topics today. And so we're going to hit number one. Any particular order you want to go through? Do you mind if I start the first one?
No, go right ahead.
So the first one is, we need to let 3-year-olds climb trees and 5-year-olds use knives. You know, there's no doubt. I mean, I don't think anybody out there could admit that there is a level of overprotectiveness that is occurring with our kids. And it seems to be getting worse. It seems as though the, you know, the reason why this resonates with me so deeply, just I guess I can also preface this for where does Trey stands on this. Mm-hmm. I was 100% on board with what she said. Jeff actually brought a really good point, and I'm kind of glad that I was going to do this at Family Podcast Network, and I'm kind of glad we did it here, because Jeff actually kind of brought a balance to this that I think we needed for this. And we'll talk some more about it as we get into these. But I was 100% on board with this idea that three-year-olds need to climb trees. We've become such a protective society of don't let them climb trees, don't let them get in places where they can be safe, you know, don't let them ride their bikes in the streets, etc. And don't get me wrong, those are all very good rules in some cases. But I think we've gone very far mm-hmm. with that. And we've gotten so overprotective, we've gotten so helicopter parent that – you know, we go back to this mentality. Well, that's just not safe. That's just not safe. And the answers, I think, has to be yes. I tell you, Jeff, just the other day, I was sitting down and we were at a restaurant and we were getting ready to eat, and we were eating with some family friends, and mm-hmm. my son is 4 year old, and he sat there for a minute, and he had gotten a little piece of meat, like a little Salisbury steak thing, mm-hmm. at the restaurant, you know, he said, "Dad, I can't eat it. It needs to be cut up." And I said, "Okay." And I handed him a knife. And I looked over at these two ladies that were sitting there, and I thought they were going to throw up, Jeff.
Because you gave your kid a steak knife?
Exactly, because I gave him a steak knife. And they were looking at me like, "Well, what are you doing? What are you doing?" And I said, "Well, he's gonna cut his meat up." And they looked at me and they said, "Well, what if he cuts his finger?" And I looked at him and I said, "Well, it's probably going to hurt." But, you know, we seem to have moved the mentality past this idea that we cannot trust our kids with certain things. Now, I want you guys to understand there's age-appropriate things and age-inappropriate things as well. Mm-hmm. There are certain things that kids do not need to be doing, right? You know, we've made it no secret in our household that we're big gun, you know, firearm folks, and we love shooting, and my wife and I are shooters, and we like to go shooting, those kinds of things. All of my kids so far have expressed an interest in being shooters one day as well. So, you know what I'm not going to do? I'm not going to hand Grant a rifle or a pistol at the age of 5. You know, we're just not going to do that. We're going to wait until they're ready. We're going to teach them. We're going to train them. And so, you know, we preface this with, you know, we need to prepare them. But we seem to have gotten so dadgum far from allowing kids to experience natural risk that they seem to begin almost, I'd even go as far to say they begin to not trust themselves.
Yeah, I can certainly see that. And I think that the key difference that in what you're saying and what I read is that she doesn't really explore the preparedness element. I mean, you're sitting here saying that you gave your son a steak knife, but presumably you have observed him, you've watched him handle himself, and you know that that even though he may struggle a little bit with it, that it's not going to be something dangerous for him. I don't believe Trey. I think you're a great dad, I cannot believe that if you had a concern that it would have been dangerous for him to have the knife, that you still would have handed it to him.
Yeah, sure.
I can resonate with that. I think I may have mentioned this to you before, but I had a similar situation as far as knives go with my daughter Eleanor this summer. We went up to Cloudcroft last July, and her cousins were whittling, right? And she was like, "Oh, hey, I want to do that." Well, Eleanor's never really handled a knife, and we're not talking, you know, butter knives or steak knives or something like that. Yeah. We're talking like the whittling knives are deliberately sharpened in order to be able to cut into wood, you know. And so before I just handed her a knife and said, "Yeah, hey, go do what your cousins are doing." I sat down with her and I said, "Okay, this is how you hold the knife. And this is how when it opens, you hold it this way so it doesn't close on you. And you always cut this direction." And I showed her how to kind of whittle the wood away from herself. And then when we went into town the next day or so, I found a nice little knife that had a locking blade so it wouldn't fold over and cut her fingers. And I told her that she had to do it at a certain spot where I could watch her until I got a sense that she was competent with it. That doesn't mean she's not going to have an accident. Doesn't mean she's not going to slip and cut her finger. But there was a reasonable level of safety that I established before I just let her go to town, you know, and just let her whittle away. And what the author here, Christine Groslow, doesn't really give us is that when she witnessed these kids in other countries doing things like a 3-year-old climbing high up in a tree at preschool, or a 5-year-old who's in the German forest whittling away on a stick with a penknife, those are the examples she gives, and that's all fine and good, but that's a snapshot of where they are right then and there. It's not a an entry into, hey, this is the first time this kid's ever climbed a tree and he doesn't know how to get back down. This isn't a, oh, hey, this is the first time this kid's ever given him, ever had a knife and we're going to give him a knife and just let him whittle away with it. But she has two little sections in each of these points that she makes. And the first one says, she mentions, we need to let three-year-olds climb trees and five-year-olds use knives, and why it's better for us to do that. And this is the point where I do agree with her, and where the principle that she gets to, I think, is kind of what you and I agree with, is she's saying that one of the things that makes it okay in those cultures is that their relaxed approach in other cultures to allowing children to take risks actually helps them become more capable. And I think that's where we as Americans – in general, kind of fall short, that we are unwilling to allow our kids to take those risks that allow them to develop the competency so that they can do those things in a way that's actually safer, because they've taken small risks until they become competent, you know? When you were talking about giving Grant a steak knife, I kind of laughed because, Grant's what, four?
Mm-hmm, yeah.
Okay. So you're talking about cutting up meat, right? Mm-hmm. So my son, Ethan, is going on 9. Actually, he's almost 10. And there are some mornings where he wants me to cut up his waffles. Okay. Waffles, mm-hmm, Trey.
Yeah.
All right. Something you can cut with the side of your fork. Okay. Now, it's faster to get a butter knife and go ahead and, zip and cut them up. But he's like, Dad, can you cut up my waffles? And I'm sitting there. No, you can do it. But do you know why he hasn't developed the ability to do it? It's not because I'm afraid it's dangerous. Mm-hmm. Do you know what my tolerance is low on?
What is it?
The mess.
Yeah.
Because
I do that too.
There's a competency in being able to cut something up without overcorrecting and flinging something off your plate, especially if it's covered in syrup. So my hesitancy to let Ethan cut his own stuff up, even at the age of 10, is because he hasn't developed the finesse. Now, part of it is on me. If I'd been giving him a knife since the age of 4 and telling him, work on it, maybe he would have better gross motor skills and he'd be able to cut his stuff up without flinging, a butter and syrup covered slice of a waffle halfway across the table that then somebody's going to have to clean up, And so it's funny that in that instance, at least, my low tolerance for the messiness is what's caused or at least contributed his inability to want to be able to say, hey, I can do this for myself and cut his own stuff up. So,
it even goes down to very, you're bringing up a really fantastic point. I hadn't even thought about this, but even to the point of like even things that don't have, for me, I should say mess or danger or mm-hmm. risk of injury associated. Like even if my daughter's like, we're getting dressed after a bath or something like that. And my 3-year-old's like, Dad, I won't do it. She wants to get dressed. Right. Mm-hmm. I'll find myself not wanting to let her do it, because what I see is she's going to come in with a pair of shorts on normal, but she's got two legs and one underwear. leg hole of her underwear, right?
Right, right.
And so now I'm seeing I'm going to have to back this, which in reality it's not that big a deal, but you're bringing up a good point in this that I hadn't considered.
It's a lot of the parents contributing.
It's my stuff, right? It's I don't want to, it all goes back to I don't want to do this. Mm-hmm. But, I consider when it comes to parenting that it's a preloading issue. We never pull punches, like over at Family Podcast Network, we never pull the punches in saying that this stuff's a pain in the butt at the start. It's hard. It's mm-hmm. really difficult. But we operate under the principle that if we do the hard work at the start, then it builds that competency level that Jeff mm-hmm. was talking about earlier, to where later in life they do it themselves, even earlier than most other kids do it. I mean, I see my 7-year-old doing some things that 15 and 16-year-olds still struggle with,
mm-hmm.
Because we've built it up and she believes that she can, and she walks into any problem, no matter how many times she messes up, knowing I'm going to get this.
That's right. And that's where the author, I think, really makes her point. And the principle is something that I absolutely agree with, that the most important safety protection you can give a kid is to let them take risks, but to let them take calculated risks, let them take educated risks, so that we're not actually putting them in dangerous situations. So I get her point. I get the principle. But I think that she opens up with that kind of shocker to get you reading. So,
but
it's a good point. It is. All right. So the next one that she mentions, she says that in other cultures, children are not finicky eaters. And so her headline is, children can go hungry from time to time.
Mm.
And she goes through and she highlights that, especially in Korea is the culture that she mentions, eating is taught to children as a life skill. They sit down to eat as a family. They don't snack from time to time. They're taught to eat the same thing that adults do. And as a result, most kids in Korean culture are incredibly broad, I guess. I don't know. They've got
they've
got great appetites.
You
know, they can sit down and they can eat anything. And she even makes makes the little aside here that I thought was interesting. Have you ever wondered why ethnic restaurants don't have kids menus?
Yeah.
I was like, yeah, I hadn't thought about that. Yeah.
Because she's right. We ate at an Indian restaurant last weekend at Maharaja's in Fort Worth, one of our favorite Indian food restaurant places. And I was thinking about that as when I flipped it up. We almost always get the buffet anyway, but I flipped it open just to see if they had some less spicy, you know, non-curry type stuff for the kids. And I noticed they didn't have anything.
Mm-hmm.
And I kind of flagged it, but I thought when I read this, I thought, holy smokes, that's got to be right.
So what she does in the next little section here is she indicates that if that's the issue, that we need to not worry so much about our kids' finicky eating, how do we handle it in America? Well, you know, I resonate with this because so often I see the struggle with food that the parents, I mean, you hear all the time, my kid can't eat this, or my kid won't eat that. Or, you know, one of my pet peeves, I see parents that tell their kids, you better eat this or eat everything that's on your plate. Or they use the guilt stuff of starving children in China or Africa, you know, would want that. So you need to eat it. And the kids buckle down and they use their stubbornness. And do you know why it works?
Why?
Because parents don't have the tolerance to let their kids go hungry, which is the point that she's making here, right? And so she mentions why it's better that in these other cultures that children are allowed to go hungry in certain cases. And we're not talking about starving our kids. That is not what the author is saying here. Just that that in American culture, I think it becomes a power and control issue rather than a health issue.
Yeah, that's a good way to put that. I like that.
Once again, parents lack the tolerance in a lot of cases to say to their kid, okay, well, you know, if you're not going to eat your food, that's okay. You'll get hungry eventually, you know, and just let them be hungry, you know. Instead, they say, okay, I'm going to save this food. I'm going to make you eat it, right? I remember stories from my family that my oldest sister, Jennifer, refused to eat something my mom had made when she was a kid. And mom, out of exasperation, you know, wanted to make sure that she had something. So she said, what will you eat? And Jennifer said, well, peanut butter and jelly. And so mom said, fine. And, you know, anytime a woman says, fine, like that, you know that you're in for trouble. And so every meal, breakfast, lunch, and dinner for the next week, Jennifer had peanut butter and jelly. To this day, Jennifer hates peanut butter and jelly. Right? But mom's point was made is that, well, hey, if that's what you'll eat, that's all you'll eat. And, well, okay, that's a parenting tactic that I can understand the conclusion, but it's not necessarily a good thing how that was handled. But I think that a lot of parents have that similar struggle, is that their kids won't eat certain things. And so the things they will eat, their parents, instead of trying to help them explore and develop a broader palate, kind of give in. So when we do go to these Americanized restaurants that, you know, these Chinese food restaurants that also have tater tots on the buffet and chicken nuggets on the buffet instead of sweet and sour chicken, and we say, oh, well, our kids like chicken nuggets and they'll eat those where they won't eat sweet and sour chicken. So we'll just kind of let it happen. And so I think as a lot of times as parents, we kind of engender this, reservedness where our kids are unwilling to try new things.
Yeah.
And it ends up not being very healthy for them, not only, emotionally healthy, but also physically healthy.
You know, I'll be honest, I loved this one. I thought this was really good. And I'll be honest, I like it, but not necessarily on experience. You know, I come from a long line of obesity that we're just finally starting to see if we can kick in our family.
Mm-hmm.
You know, but I'm going to be honest, on principle, we really do like this. We've just started adopting a lot of these things at home, especially about that. But, you know, I was thinking about this, Jeff. You know, we've become such an engorged society. You know, we have and we eat and like you mentioned earlier, there's just a plethora. I mean, just a massive plethora of food that we have access to. And not only that, we have it in just almost limitless quantities. You know, it's not there. You know, if the trucks stop rolling, it's not on the shelves, but you know, there's so much of it. And, you know, this is such an issue for us because we've become, I don't know, I guess maybe kind of the microwave society. We like everything instantly. We want it quick. We want it fast. You know, we don't want to have to take time, you know, to build up for it. And, you know, there's a concept that's out there that's called hedonism. And hedonism basically states that the ultimate good, the thing to be focused on, is pleasure. And the ultimate thing to be avoided is pain.
Mm-hmm.
And that's very Americanized culture right there. We do what feels good. We do what we like. We do what we enjoy. And we avoid those things that we don't enjoy, that bring us pain or whatever else. Well, you can see how that becomes an issue. You know, most people are like, well, yeah, what's wrong with that? Well, in reality, if you take a look at it, some of the best things in life come through pain. I mean, babies, for instance, come through a lot of pain. If we took that approach, we probably wouldn't have babies. You take that approach with exercise or whatnot, right? I mean, exercise is painful.
Sure.
And yet it's some of the best things that we can do for our body, you know, and it helps keeps us healthy and solid. But, you know, we've become so hedonistic. We've become so engorged that our kids, I mean, they don't even have to not be picky, you know?
Right.
And that's a major issue for us in our family. You know, we kind of take that approach that we make what we make for lunch, and if you don't eat it, you weren't hungry enough, you know? Then for supper we can try again if you want to try again and whatnot. But you know, I like this one. I like this idea outside of just the going hungry part of it, the food aspect of it.
Right.
I like the opportunity to give kids a chance to feel frustrated.
And that's the point I think the author's making. She's using the food idea as the entry point to this overall principle that there is a discipline of self-control that we do not exercise and develop in our kids as a society. And I believe this in general to be true, that for a lot of American families, we have not developed that sense of the value of waiting.
Yeah, that's good.
And so she goes on to say here that you know, she uses Korea and as a culture as far as how they eat, and then she transitions to French. And she mentions in one paragraph that the French, as well as many others, believe that routinely giving your child a chance to feel frustration gives him a chance to practice the art of waiting and developing self-control. Now, this is where I think American culture has definitely been taken over by that hedonism idea that you were talking about, Trey. And I think that was very well put, that we don't like to tolerate uncomfortableness.
Yeah.
It's all about feeling good.
Yeah.
And that has become the prime value. Is we've taken this, you know, everybody has the right to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Mm. And we've misunderstood that to everybody has the right to life, liberty, and immediate happiness.
Oh, nice. Well put.
And because we have not learned the value of the pursuit, the value of the challenge of trying to find happiness, we assume that it's a right. And I think that that you mentioned a couple of things, that immediate gratification, the impulsivity, that you called it a microwave culture. And I love that, because when I talk to parents about impulsivity in teens, I try to highlight for them something that they see all the time. They see their kids being impulsive. And honestly, it's a developmental thing in kids. I think that by nature, children want immediate gratification.
Yeah.
And so it's not something that's a bad thing. I think it's a natural thing. However, reality teaches us that we can't always have what we want, right? And so we learn to develop patience, and we learn to develop self-control. We learn some of those self-disciplines through those tough times. And yet, when we get to be parents, we kind of get this idea of, man, that was really hard for us to go through. I don't want my kid to have to, quote unquote, suffer through those things. And so I'm going to give them instead. And unfortunately, what we're doing is we're short circuiting the process, because in giving them everything, we're actually teaching them to expect immediate gratification.
That's good.
Now, she mentioned that the French routinely give their children chances to feel frustrated, right? And delaying gratification. So there's some interesting, really interesting stuff about delayed gratification that I talk about. You know, to help parents understand that it's not necessarily the best value to teach our kids that we need to immediately gratify stuff, because we see our kids being really impulsive, and yet we only focus on their impulsivity, and we don't see how we're feeding into it. For instance, you mentioned the microwave stuff. I ask kids sometimes, how long does it take to make a burrito? And they say, well, you know, it takes, what, 30 seconds in the microwave? Maybe 60 seconds if you like it really piping hot, right? That's how long it takes to make a burrito. I'm like, no. Well, first you got to take the flour and you got to make a tortilla, right? And that can take a little while. And then you have to take the beans. You got to mash them down into a paste so that you can – and, you know, to really make a burrito, it takes quite a bit longer than 60 seconds. But we live in this generation where everything is processed and prepared.
Yeah, that's good.
And so we can have it. And so the parents are sitting here, you know, when I'm giving this point, and they're laughing about it. And they're like, oh, yeah, ha, ha, that's right. And I say, okay. But parents, how much do we partake of that is instantaneous.
Yeah.
That as adults, we think that we've just arrived, and so yeah, we've already suffered through all that stuff. Like, for instance, it used to be if you wanted something, you had to wait until the stores were open to go get it, right? Not so anymore, because we have 24/7 service, right? Yeah. Yeah. I can go out at any hour of the night and walk into a convenience store, walk into Walmart, and it's accessible to me. And not just merchandise, but also entertainment or information or communication. We have devices that we carry around in our hands that allow us instant access to a lot of things that it used to be that we had to wait for those things, and we had to be patient for those things. And now we have given ourselves the ability to be impatient and to reward impatience.
Yeah.
So I think it's remarkable that that even as adults, we don't realize how much that we are feeding into and partaking of the now, and kind of short-circuiting the process of helping our kids to develop patience, tolerance, frustration, self-control, and that discipline.
You know, I think it's one of the natural propensities for parents to see our kids frustrated and having a hard time solving a problem, and the natural response is we want to come in and fix it for them. Sure. We want to make it go away. We don't like seeing them frustrated. Mm-hmm. But you know, the reality is, I think there has to be kind of a paradigm shift with this to stop seeing that as the thing to be avoided, right? Mm-hmm. The hedonia mindset, and move it into this mindset. That's the goal. That is where the gold happens with them. You know, Family Podcast Network was created out of frustration. I was tired of going and doing jobs with what I'm good at that didn't pay a whole lot of money. And really, there was so much junk that I had to do that I was not good at, that I mm-hmm. did not like. Or at least I could be good at, but I didn't care enough about it to be good at, like, the paperwork stuff.
Right.
So that frustration pushed me to a point where I was like, you know what? Forget this. I will build a job that eventually I can live off of that is what I love. It's what I love to do. It's everything what I enjoy, and then whatever I don't, I'll contract out with people to do it for me, right?
Mm-hmm.
That frustration is what got us there. My daughter taught herself how to read by herself because of frustration, it was very strategic, but we bought her a dinosaur book that had tons of cool information, and mm-hmm. we probably read 2 or 3 pages of it just to get her mouth watering. Mm-hmm. Literally, she was just looking at it with this giant saucer eyes, and she's like, what does this say, Daddy? You know what? I tell you what, baby, if you want to know what that says, you're going to have to learn how to read it. But Dad, and she was so angry and so frustrated. But Dad, what does this say about this? What's this picture mean? I said, sweetie, you're going to have to learn. I mean, you're going to. And let me tell you, she sat down, and I'm telling you, my 6-year-old daughter taught herself to read in 2 weeks because she was ready to know what the dinosaur book said. You see, frustration, I know we're kind of ruminating on this really long, but I think this is so good. And I think it is something that is pervasive, and I think it is, and I struggle with it as well. I'm raising my hand as well.
Mm-hmm.
But I think it is something that we are shortchanging our kiddos because we are not allowing them to get just dog frustrated, angry, just can't, you know, and then just let them loose. Let them off that chain and let them solve those problems. Let them fail a little bit. Let them fix that failure. And I'm telling you, man, I thought this is very insightful. I mean, this is a culturally insightful thing. Way to go, French.
Mm-hmm. So if necessity is the mother of invention, would you say that maybe a corollary to that might be frustration is the mother of competency?
See, I love that. That's actually a brilliant – let's quote that. That's a Jeff quote.
That's
right
a Jeff Emery quote, original right there.
Right there. I think that's beautiful.
You know, actually, that's a good segue, talking about learning to read and education, into the next point that Christine Grosslohn makes here. And her next point is that children should spend less time in school. Did you catch that, Trey? Less time in school. Now, I know that that you'll be able to talk a little bit more about this when I relinquish the mic to you here again, but because this is something that you guys believe in. But the point that she makes here is from the culture of Finland.
And amazing school system, by the way. If you ever get a chance, go just Wikipedia Finland school system. Mm-hmm. It's cool.
Well, and she mentions here and even references the Finnish model of education that has kids starting school when they're closer to 7 years old. Whereas here in America, we've got early head start. We got kids trying to get them into school, start educating them at the age of, 3. And we think, hey, the earlier the better, right? And yet here, the Finnish, from Finland, that model of education says, yeah, not only are we going to wait until they're 7 to really start any kind of formal academics, but, if we're teaching them more than 45 minutes at a time, we're really kind of not doing what kids need, because they need time to run around and they need to have breaks. They need to have shorter school hours, and their focus is not on high academic achievement. They're not doing star tests and things where they're doing standardized testing until until they get to the later end of the education spectrum. In the beginning, we've got more stuff that, art and music and things like that. Home economics and life skills are being emphasized at a younger age. And, things like math and science are things that they, once they show an interest in, well, then they push those kids into the hard sciences and things like that. And, as a result, the international standards and the results that they've had is that the Finnish education model ranks as one of the best in the world.
Did you know also that the Finnish teachers are one of the top three highest paid professions in Finland? I'm telling you, I get giddish about the Finnish. I mean, I'm so serious, man, that I love their model. If we had a Finnish system here, I would actually consider putting them in public school. My kid is in public school because I love this. Were you done, Joe?
Yeah.
Okay. I get really excited about this topic. And when I get excited about stuff, sometimes I have a tendency to be rude and cut people off. But I love this. I'm telling you, as I have practiced the way that we do homeschool. Now, we're kind of a unique sect of homeschooling that we call unschooling.
Mm-hmm.
And just real briefly, the mentality of unschooling is that if we leave kids to their devices, we give them curiosity, we give them resources and information, they will naturally go seek out these things themselves, that they will teach themselves. And so, typically it takes, an entire year for them, maybe a couple years before they get them to reading level, right?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I would say that on average, and there's those that just pick it up just within just a lickety split. There's those that sometimes it takes, you know, several years before they really pick up reading. But my daughter on her own, 6 years old, picked up reading by herself because she wanted it. And so the unschooling says that our jobs as parents is not to fill them with educational ideas, right? It's not to teach to them and give them things that they have to memorize, because that's all it really comes down to. It's typically memorization and the things that they forget later.
Sure.
But if you can find things that they're passionate about and you can get them connected to that, then they will actually learn themselves. So the goal is not to give them information. It's about to give them resources to fuel their passion to learn.
Give them the skill to develop their own competency once
exactly.
Again.
Exactly. And so I love everything she's talking about here. I think if we could bring the Finns over here, I think it's great. I hate high achievement tests.
Mm-hmm.
I think that does nothing. But there was a Calvin and Hobbes thing that I put on Family Podcast Network Facebook page the other day, if y'all want to go check it out. But it was like, when did the pilgrims come in, and land? And he put on there 17 whatever and, or 14 whatever. And then right below it, he added a segue. He said, so look, now you – he goes – now, this is the last time I'm going to use this piece of trivial information. I'll probably never remember it again. So I'm going to go home today and forget it. And all you've taught me is how to manipulate the system or something to that effect. But that's the mentality, I think, is that we teach kids here in America in such a way that it is about memorization of information, not about authentically learning it. It's
right.
Not about it sticking. It's not about it really becoming something that's a part of them that they can remember and implement. It's just about how good am I going to do on a tax test? How well am I going to do on the STAR test? How am I going to do on the benchmark test? And so I think the Finns have nailed it when it comes to all of this. I love the fact that they reemphasize art, music, the creative side of the brain. And because it's been shown that when you can activate and stimulate the creative side of the brain, that it even helps memory retention better. That's why they often encourage in studying that you use highlighters and things like that, because the different colors help stimulate that creative side of the brain to memorize. And I tell you, I think the Finns are getting it.
All right, so here's where I've got a bit of a gripe, Trey.
Well, all right,
let me jump in here.
I'm ready.
She links in her article a hyperlink. You can click it, and it takes you to a report on the Finnish model of education. And what you have to understand here is that this brief paragraph in here where she says children should spend less time in school is true under those conditions. The Finnish model of education has not always been what it is now. As a matter of fact, they have spent literally a lifetime. I mean, we're talking 45 years since the end of World War II, developing this mentality. And the article that she links to does a great job talking about the history of the Finnish education model. And although it works for the Finns, I don't think it's a directly comparable transition to American society. I don't think that you can say, if we did exactly what the Finns do in America, if we just copied what they're doing, that we would have success. And that's where I have a gripe about about her presentation here. Not that the Finns have it wrong. As a matter of fact, they've got a lot of things right. And like you said, a lot of things that are admirable. But in order to implement them in American society, it would take a mind shift, a mental paradigm shift in the American education model and in a societal mindset. And so once again, I don't disagree with anything that you said, but I don't think that you can say apples to apples, oranges to oranges. This is a direct comparison. Part of it is just the scope. The population of Finland is less than the population of New York, right? And so their ability to do things and their economy and their lifestyle and their culture plays into their ability to have this education model. Now, are there some things that we should work towards? Yes. Are there some things that we should say, hey, how do we develop this culture? And then when we have the same culture, we can have the same success with how they're doing things. But I really think that that if we just tried to implement this directly in America, that we would run into a lot of roadblocks.
No, you know, in reality, Jeff, you and I really do completely agree. I think you're right. This is what you're talking about. What I'm hearing you say is that this is a paradigm shift. Again, going back to that paradigm shift, mm-hmm. This is something that you would probably have to kind of dysregulate people's thinking in mm-hmm. one capacity and then kind of reteach.
Yes.
Some of them are probably going to be so indoctrinated mm-hmm. in the American model. Some of the teachers are just going to kind of have to retire. We're going to have to get our new ones in with the new doctrine. I 100% agree with you. It is 100% – everything that you just stated a minute ago is the reason why we homeschool. It's not that we don't trust other people. It's just that under the current system, under the current model, there are wonderful, wonderful men and women out there teaching kids that have been indoctrinated with a system and a model that I don't think is effective. I mean, mm-hmm. what would you say, if you guess, what would you say are the two most, quote-unquote, important subjects that we teach in America?
As far as knowledge that kids should have to live?
Yeah. Just those classes that we say, well, what are the primary things we need to teach kids?
I think we need to teach kids how to read and how to learn, but that's not what you're asking.
Well, you know, I'm sorry, I set you up on that one. But.
Well, yeah, and I kind of dodged your question on that because I think that you and I are on the same page. If we give kids the ability to teach themselves, then they will be lifelong learners.
If
we simply say you need to learn algebra and without any kind of contextualization and we plug the importance of algebra, is algebra important? Well, yeah, and it irks me to hear kids say, I'll never use algebra again after I get out of school. If you go to the supermarket and you compare prices or you try to figure out how much per ounce something is, you're solving for X, kid. You're doing algebra.
Uh-huh. Yeah, I use it all the time. I'll go and I'll look and I can get a liter of this for that much, or I can get 12 ounces for that. So then I'm converting the mm-hmm. to a standard measurement, and then I'm doing my proportioning. You know, X over this is equals to this over that. And then I do my proportion. I'm like, oh, okay, so this is the better deal, because this one's this much per ounce, and then this one is this much. But no, it's huge like that. But you know, I think what we say is the most important is, again, I apologize if I set you up on that, but you know, we say things like math and science and reading. You know, those are those most popular things that we should be teaching. But I find it interesting that even still we score right in the middle mm-hmm. of, you know, of the world populations of scores. We still score in the middle of them. And the reality is I don't think it works. And I completely agree with you that I mean, there's no way we could get it done. There's no way we could, just like you said, just copy this and paste it into ours and then get it there and say, boom, this is going to work. And like I said, that is the reason why we pulled our kids home. We believe mm-hmm. that other people are trustworthy. We believe that people have that heart for teaching and could do it probably even better than we do. But the reality is it's going to be so long before we can get to that. You know, it was just kind of like, well, yeah, maybe not.
So as an interesting kind of segue into the next point here, we're sitting here talking about autonomy and teaching our children how to teach themselves and becoming lifelong learners. And yet the very next point that she makes here is thou shalt spoil thy baby. And she goes into looking at Japanese culture that looks at some kids that look like they're incredibly independent. She talks about a boy named Tomo, who's a 10-year-old boy who had walked to school on his own since he was 6 years old. He takes good care of his belongings. He arranges his shoes just so. He knows how to ride the city bus, right? And he's so helpful and responsible that when you go home, it's a weird thing to see that they do a lot of things that we would consider spoiling our kids. They co-sleep. They allow their children to not be as responsible at home, not to necessarily have chores and things like that. And She mentions that that when in Japan, when a baby cries, the Japanese respond immediately. They pick them up and they hold them constantly. Whereas over here, we're like, you got to let them cry it out. You got to learn how to help them self-soothe, right? And so what we think of as spoiling, the Japanese think that when their babies get their needs met and they're loved unconditionally as infants, mm-hmm. they become more easily independent and self-assured as they grow. And so it's kind of a contrast to this, what we're saying. You know, we got to let kids be frustrated. We got to let them learn how to teach themselves. And yet, oh, we also have to spoil them. We also have to coddle them. And we also have to. So what is she talking about here, Trey?
You know, the reference is this. Babies cry for one reason, and that is to express a need, whether it is my diaper's wet, you know, I've got poop diaper, I'm hungry, I'm cold, I'm hurting, my teeth are coming in. Little babies do not manipulate. They just mm-hmm. don't. They get their needs met in any way they can. And the one, I guess you might call it the instinctual thing that they've been taught to do, is it's coded into their DNA or whatever you want to see it as.
Yeah.
They cry. It's just what they do. And I'm telling you guys, I'm not hating on anybody who takes the scheduling approach. I've got a lot of family members that do. And I say that because we did it with our first one and a half. And we did the schedule. We need to teach them to self-soothe. We did put them in the room and let them cry it out. And it's one of the things that breaks my heart the most about that with Anna. I mean, poor Anna. She got to be the
guinea pig
for so many things. and I'm so glad that she's so forgiving. But we read up on this.
Mm-hmm.
And we started adopting this nurturing parent program, you know, this idea that kids just need their needs met. And I have found it is one of the single most best decisions, right up there with us deciding to do the non-aggressive principle mm-hmm. in our parenting. It is one of the single best things that we've ever done. I mean, my kids are Do you know how? No, but I'll figure it out. I mean, they are very, very independent and very, very self-reliant, and they trust themselves. And so much so that, I mean, like, we're so crunchy granola, Jeff, that we literally carry our little babies with us everywhere.
Mm-hmm.
I carry what's called an ergo front pack that can mm-hmm. be converted into a backpack, and my wife carries what's called a Mobi wrap, which was actually is copied from what they do in Africa.
Right.
And it's a type of wrap, and we carry those with us everywhere we go because our little babies stay on us one way or the other.
Mm-hmm.
And they go back and forth, and the reasoning behind that goes back to, you know, she calls it spoiling and whatnot. You know, there's a difference between spoil and blessed or whatever you want to call it, you mm-hmm. know. And but I like that mentality, is that kids need to be picked up, they need to be comforted, they need to be held tight, and they need to stay close to us, and mm-hmm. you're not going to over-baby them. The babying thing is not necessarily about what you're doing, but the motivation behind doing it. If you're trying to pull some kind of happiness, or if it's about making me feel better because you're close, and it's not about trying to meet a kiddo's need. Yeah, that's exactly right. And I think that's what most of the antagonists to this are kind of vouching about, is that, well, this is bad for them because – and they're right. In those cases, when mamas or daddies are trying to make themselves feel better by having baby close
– yeah, that's the wrong point.
That's not good for baby at all. But when it is about, I'm meeting their need, I'm keeping them close, I mean, you got to think. Little baby spent 9 months wrapped up in a nice little tight ball stuck in mama's belly where it's mm-hmm. warm, and she could hear mama talking all the time. And they've even talked about how babies respond to the heartbeat of mama. So they're hearing mama's, you know, heartbeat in there.
Right.
And then all of a sudden they're out, you know, and that's a pretty rough transition. And so meeting baby's needs, when they start crying, they're not doing it because they're trying to – let me rephrase that. This is the ideology of if the baby's crying, it's not that they're trying to manipulate you or they just don't want to go to bed. They are trying to get a need met. Even if that need is, we put them in a bed and we walked out, right? This is a kid who's lived inside of mama 9 months. We stick them in a bed and then we leave them by themselves.
You know, what I'm kind of getting as I'm listening to you, as I'm reading through this, is that we're talking about different stages of kids. And we're not saying that we should spoil our 12-year-olds. We're
right.
saying we should spoil
right.
our,
yes.
our babies and meet their needs
Correct.
As babies so that they learn, which is one of the things that babies do as soon as they come into the world, is they start trying to figure out
yes.
whether or not their world is a safe place where they can explore safely and grow in safety.
That's good.
When the world is not a safe place, well, they become mistrustful and they develop all these issues. But when the world is a safe place where their needs are met and they're taken care of, it allows them to develop that independence that makes them better learners and more independent, more autonomous as they grow into some of the later stages of development. So whereas before we've been kind of talking in general about all life stages as far as or not all childhood stages about, you know, letting them learn how to build skills and become competent with safety and taking risks. Well, that happens at every stage of development. And letting them develop frustration. Well, once again, that's something that they probably need to, it's a process that they need to learn how to deal with frustration a little bit as a baby, but more as a toddler and more as a little kid, more as an adolescent developing those things. And, but when it comes to, spoiling, that's needs to happen when they're very young babies, is what I hear her saying here.
Yeah. One other thing I do want to speak to on this is the Christine in this brings up the idea of co-sleeping, and she references some studies that have shown that co-sleeping with kids makes them more independent, self-reliant, and those kinds of things than those that are kind of stuck in their own rooms and other, you know, in beds in their own rooms and stuff like that. I do want to – we have co-slept every single one of our kids. We've got four of them right now, and we've co-slept every single one of them, and I always wish people could come meet my kids. Because I'm always afraid that people just think that I make this stuff up. But, I mean, my kids are so independent. They all want to sleep in their own beds now. They do. They didn't get stuck. They're not, you know, my 7-year-old doesn't, or my 6-year-old, about to be 7, doesn't sit in the bed and want to sleep with us and get scared when she gets out. I remember that day where she walked in and said, "Dad, can I have my own bed now?" You absolutely got it. Let's get you set up today. You know, we already had one set up in anticipation, but kids, it brings a sense of comfort to them. Mm-hmm. You know, and I take a look at, you know, where this really caught my attention, where we made this decision was Corey and I both were actually in our undergrad. We'd just gotten married, and she's got a bachelor's in psychology as well. And so we were in a class together, and the guy who was teaching it was actually Vietnamese.
Mm-hmm.
And he was talking about during Vietnam, he and his family were the last people let through the line from Vietnam as immigrants before they closed it off.
Wow.
They walked through, they let all him through, and they closed it off, and the Vietnam War started. And so kind of a neat story that he was there for that. But but he always talked about it. He said, you know, this idea of sticking kids in another room, he said, it's almost beyond my understanding. He said, in Vietnam, every single person in the family slept in one bed, one room, same place, right there next to each other. That's just what you did. And I think it's the best way to do it is keeping kids close. It gives them comfort and security. Again, for somebody who's lived inside you for so long, staying close to you, I think is the best thing that you can do with them. But I stand as a walking living testament that if you co-sleep your kids, you will not mess them up. They do not become, you know, mommy's girls and daddy's, you know, boys or whatever else. I mean, they really do become independent, and then eventually all of mine have said, I'm ready to get in my own bed, every single one of them.
And the caveat there, Trey, is I don't disagree with you, and I don't even have a problem with co-sleeping necessarily. But as you mentioned, when there are parental issues where we're doing it to get our needs met, then it can be done wrong. Once again, I don't think co-sleeping is universal for everybody necessarily.
Yeah, sure.
You know, that it's something that parents have to be ready to do and to do it correctly so that they're actually meeting kids' needs and not necessarily having their needs met. So just a little caveat there. Okay, so this last point that she makes here in the article is that children need to feel obligated. And it goes back to what you started off talking about, Trey, which was very well said, that we have created this adolescent life period for our kids, and that in adolescence we are still doing some of that spoiling and coddling and not asking them to step up and be responsible. And so once they get to adolescence, we start trying to give them freedom. We want to help them become more independent. But unfortunately we haven't started the process early enough, and because we're doing it in this adolescent period, we're meeting a lot of challenges. We're meeting a lot of rebellion. We're meeting a lot of just a lot of pushback when our kids suddenly have to go to learning to be responsible when they should have been learning it all along. And so when we get that pushback, a lot of times, in my view, as parents in American society, we cave. We don't make them feel obligated. And so we say, well, you know, it's worked well all these years for us to kind of give them what they need, so we'll just keep doing that. Whereas in other cultures, like China is what the author quotes here, is that the older the children get, the more parents remind them of their obligations and help them to try to be dutiful, right? And I think that that's probably a cultural stereotype, but I think that we do see it a lot that families of Asian origin do have kids of all ages, whether they're firstborn or second or the lastborn, that are highly dutiful and highly obligated because that is part of their culture.
Yeah. You know, I think that's really good. You know, this was kind of reminding me of a, you know, kind of a mentality that we practice at Casa de Gibson. So, you know, over at the Casa de Gibson, we kind of have a belief system of responsibility. You know, it reminds me of my daughter, Anna, and she wanted a cat a while back, Jeff. Mm-hmm. And she said, "Dad, I want a cat." And I said, "Well, do you understand what cat means? It means you're going to have this, you're going to have that responsibility, you're going to do a litter box,
right.
You got to feed her, you know, you're the one who's going to take care of her. If she pee-pees on something, you got to clean it all up." And so we really set her up with those expectations. And she looked me in the eyes and said, "Dad, I'll do all of that."
I've heard that before. I mean, we've avoided pet ownership in our house for so long.
And so I said, okay. And I said, "Here we go." So we went and we let her pick out her cat and we took her home. And she did really good those first 2 weeks, especially. But right about that third week, she was working on something and she was just engrossed in reading something, and she was at the time, funny enough, she was actually the story of teaching herself to read because she wanted to read that book. And so she was in the middle of something and she was just busting it, trying to get this done and just working and focusing. And I said, "Anna, can you clean the litter box out today?" And we're very respectful to our kids. We don't just tell them, "Do it right now," because I said. Mm-hmm. We just say, "Hey, we need it done today, preferably before this time because we've got to be at church," and those kinds of things. And she said, "Well, Dad, I'm working on this. Can you do it?" And so my natural response was, my first thought was, knee jerk was, "Well, heck no, sucker, this is your cat. This is your cat," you know. And then that second problem is, "Oh no, this is going to lead to this argument or this discussion or, Dad, why? Why can't we do this now? I'm working on the," you know. And so, of course, you know, what happens is that, you know, there I go. Corey threw a flag and said, "Trey, you're doing the lazy parenting thing here again." And she threw the flag on me because what was happening was, I didn't want to hold her obligated or hold her responsible to that because mm-hmm. I didn't want to have to mess with the mess.
Yeah.
And so what was happening was I was actually removing her obligation and her responsibility. But finally I came back. I said, "Anna, you really are going to need to take care of that. I know you're working on something, but you had said," and it would have been so much easier just to take that litter box out myself. Mm-hmm. And I said, "It is your responsibility. You said this is a part of wanting to have that cat." And she said, "Okay, Dad." And she got up and she went in there and she took it out. And funny enough, the weirdest reaction, I thought she would be kind of, you know, embittered by that and kind of upset that she had to stop that. And I tell you, Jeff, she seemed to actually like it. She appreciated that fact that she went and did that. And I'm guessing that, I mean, this, I really don't know what causes it, mm-hmm. but I'm guessing based off of how I react to those kinds of things, it gives us that buy-in that says, this is mine. This is, you know, to go cast away the fire with whom I have created. You know, mm-hmm. it's that mentality of mm-hmm. we have built this. It is my responsibility. And I think there really is some level that obligation does, I don't know, almost create a sense of freedom, you know, a sense of
self-worth. I mean,
self-worth, that's what I'm looking for, exactly.
Yeah, it makes you feel good about yourself to know that there's something that you've done that you can point to and say, "I did that," or "This is a result of my willingness, my ability to get stuff done." And I don't disagree. I really like the idea of creating a sense of obligation in our kids. I don't think that it's unhealthy, but I think that there's a balance, because the sources that the author cites here is from Chinese culture. And I think that Asian cultures in general have a reputation, even almost a stereotype, for being highly dutiful and highly obligated. That their children, regardless of birth order, like here in America, you know, the first oldest child tends to be highly dutiful and responsible, but not so much with following children. In Asian cultures, that seems to not be the case. It seems to have a different level of obligation and sense of duty throughout all the children. And even though I think that there's a level of admiration, that obligation. And according to her, studies that she references here indicate that children who are reminded of their obligations typically have higher achievement, higher success, later in life. And so, you know, she cites these things as why it's better for these other cultures and why maybe we should be asking ourselves that question here in America. But once again, I run into this, okay, just because it works in that culture doesn't necessarily mean it will work in this culture. After you and I talked about this article and we'd read through it, I ran across the next day another article that almost is the reverse side of the coin of
the
this
antithesis.
Exactly, of this this Asian Chinese style parenting, and it was a book written by a Yale law professor whose name is Amy Chua. She said that Chinese style parenting drives Asian American children to succeed in ways that what she calls permissive Western style parenting does not. Mm-hmm. However, another professor kind of resented that and said, "No, what she calls tiger parenting or tiger mom, where there's this almost oppressive sense of obligation put on kids, it may drive higher short-term outcomes, but long-term studies, and she cites a bunch of studies here, show that that tiger parenting can actually be really detrimental. And part of her response here to tiger parenting is research-based, and part of it is experiential-based. She said in one place, "I don't have a whole lot of scientific evidence, but I'm 43, and my entire life I've met Asian kids who are under so much pressure or were so ashamed that they got a B because no matter how hard they tried, they felt like they could never measure up." And so what I want to point out here is that there's probably a balance. What works well in Asian cultures is not going to work well in American culture because it's a different culture. And when you take this, what works well in this culture, and just drag it straight across into American culture and drop it in and expect it to work, I don't think it's going to work without a paradigm shift. So my response to this end is, do we need to help our children feel more obligated, more dutiful? Yes. I think that there is an extent to which that would be helpful in American society. Do we need to do it to the degree that Asian families do or Asian cultures do? No, I don't think that works in American society. So there's a place for shift and change here, but I think that there's a point at which it would become detrimental for us to do. So I agree with her in principle, but not in practice.
This has been such a good article. Well, guys, we have hit the hour-long mark.
Lots of good stuff.
Yeah. You going to take us out, Jeff?
Yeah. You know, every week we've got good stuff on here, Trey. And whether you agree with us or disagree with us, we hope that this this podcast is something that helps you to go deeper in your parenting. And honestly, as we're sitting here citing this research and stuff we find in the webs and articles, and, you know, we've indicated that Trey and I are speaking not only from our experience, but also from education, where we're going through and we're researching this stuff. And we want to encourage you guys, if there's something that sounds off to you or if there's something that you really like, don't take our word for it. Go out and do your own research.
Oh, yeah. You know, yes.
There's tons of information out there, and it's freely accessible and available to all of us. So we hope that the stuff we bring up is stuff that's interesting and that's thought-provoking, but you need to find a way to make it work in your family, right? Just like Trey and I have found ways to make this stuff work in our families. We do so much appreciate the ability to share this stuff with you. And, you know, if you have something you want to say to us, if you have questions, if you have comments, if you have any kind of feedback, we'd love to hear it. We'd love for you to get on the web and shoot us an email. You can leave us a voicemail. You can comment on the webpage. You can like us on Facebook. There are so many different ways to get in contact with the Family Podcast Network, the Real Family Guys, and we'd love to hear from you. So I would just encourage you, as you listen to us from week to week, give us that feedback. Let us know what you want to hear, what you don't like to hear. If you have some questions and you want to throw them at us so that we can try and answer them, we'd love to do that for you as well. But more than anything, we want to keep doing this for you guys because we enjoy doing it. And we want to help you guys do the same thing that we're doing for ourselves, and that is be the best parents we can be for our kids, because they deserve it.
We'll see you guys next week.
Bye now.